Hey everybody, just before we start the episode, I just wanted to say very sorry for the lack of episodes released recently. Just been really busy getting DNF up and going again after the pandemic, and obviously we've expanded a lot, so now we've got 4 weekly events around the city. So check out our website, dungeonsandflagons.co.uk, if you're interested in coming to any of those. We've also got big plans for the all-dayers from next year. We're going to be trying to build on those, so lots going on. So yeah. But in the future, I'm hoping to release some more podcast episodes a bit more often. We've got plans for them. We've got some stuff recorded already. Just need to find time to edit. So yeah. Anyway, on with the episode. Welcome to Last Games Night on Earth, the podcast where we discuss if you were given just one last games night, what would you wish for? My name is James, and this is the Dungeons and Flagons podcast.
You back?
Oh. Have you been waiting for me?
I have. I did say hi, but...
I must have had my earphones off. Sorry, man. I've been waiting for you.
Oh, dear.
We would have sat like that for hours.
Hashtag just podcast things.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Last Games Night on Earth. We are joined by Jonathan today.
Hi, James. I am well, thank you. Yes, yeah. I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. Cool. So you're going to tell us a little bit about your Dreams Games Night. But first of all, do you want to tell us a little bit about you?
So I am Jonathan, as you say. I am a biology teacher and RPG player and kind of, but not really, designer and board games enthusiast and general nerd, I suppose.
Excellent. Cool. So, your dream games night, where do you want to start?
I suppose we'll start with the place where everyone's going to be rocking up to play these games. I think that's always important to kind of set the scene.
Excellent. So the location. Where is location X?
So my location of choice is one that I have a lot of fond childhood memories of, is the Blue Planet Aquarium in Merseyside, if you've been.
I've not been to the one in the Merseyside. I've been to the one in Copenhagen, though.
Ah, yeah, no, there's one in Ellesmere Port, kind of just outside of Liverpool, kind of Merseyside way. And yeah, I went there all the time as a kid. As I said, I'm a biology teacher, so I have a lot of kind of affinity for animals and animal life and that sort of thing. And
I always remember when I got into Copenhagen, the first thing I saw was an advert for the Blue Planet Aquarium that had big otters on it, and I was just like, this is the first place I'm going.
That I would be immediately hooked as well. Thank you for warning me if I ever do.
It was literally the first thing. I was there for like a really nice cultural experience, but the first thing I saw was otters and was just like, all right, I guess we're going to a tourist attraction.
Yeah, that would get me. Yeah, specifically in terms of the aquarium, though, Blue Planet has this absolutely wonderful floor-to-ceiling, like 2 stories high tank. So as you're kind of going through the aquarium, you're kind of walking through and there's lots of like smaller tanks and things like that, and you're kind of seeing like jellyfish and starfish and rays and things like that, and then you come around the corner, it's just this room in this like wishy kind of blue light, is this sort of really magical atmosphere, and then you turn the corner and there is literally this like 2-story high tank, and you've got like sharks swimming around it and like eels and all sort of beautiful, colourful fish and like turtles, and yeah,
they're really cool, aren't they? Like in even the one in what's it called, Animal Travel Crossing? Center?
Oh yes, sorry, I thought you were talking about a real one there. Even the fake one,
even the fake one is like walking around the Animal Crossing aquarium was the best bit for me.
I agree entirely. I didn't play a great deal of Animal Crossing, but obviously existing in the year of our Lord 2020, I did play a little bit of Animal Crossing.
Didn't get into it past a couple of weeks either, to be honest. Girlfriend's still playing it, but But yeah, no, I totally get what you mean though. Those like massive aquariums. I remember the one in Blackpool. It was a bit naff, but anyway, you used to be able to book it out for birthdays. And that was always really nice. I used to love that.
Yeah, like I said, I just like to. My only worry would be if I accidentally kind of fall asleep, if I'm just kind of with the nice sort of calming light and the sort of gentle washing of the water and the swimming fish. That could be my only worry, is if I fall asleep halfway through the night.
Yeah, they're a little bit hypnotic, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah.
I think that would be a really good location. Do any of your games kind of like feed into that?
Yeah, I mean, I believe Azul literally translates to blue, so that could potentially tie in a little bit. Blue planet, Azul planet. That tenuous link, but yeah, I think that's going with the theme ish.
Yeah, have you ever played like a board game in a place like the aquarium?
Oh, that is a very good question, James. I'm not sure. The most fun time I've ever played, or the most weirdest time I've ever played a game, was I introduced a person. I was at a New Year's party, and as I inevitably do at any party, I ended up talking about tabletop role-playing games. and I basically sold this guy on the idea of RPGs, to the point that at like 1 a.m. on the 1st of January, I was running a guy through the Tomb of the Serpent King's dungeon using Into the Odd. I had my dice on me, because I always have my dice on me, of course. And yeah, just kind of, like I say, everyone else is kind of drinking and singing and all this sort of thing. And then there's the two of us literally sat in the middle of the room, just like on the sofa, with just rolling some dice on the floor and just playing an RPG.
It's like the nerdy equivalent of the guy with the acoustic guitar.
That is a very good description of me, James. Yes, I will always insert my particular hobby into any conversation. And yeah, at any opportunity, just like someone say Dungeons & Dragons? Someone say Dungeons & Dragons?
Amazing. Let me show you my dice. Cool. All right.
So geeky.
I meant that to sound quite innocent. It did sound seedy. Right. Anything else you want to say about your location?
No, I just think, like I say, it's just the vibes that I really like. Yeah, I just think it's a really nice atmosphere.
Yeah, it's relaxing. And also, one thing that kind of like jumps into my mind is, I know you said about falling asleep and it, you know, we said about it being quite hypnotic, but also I feel like it's one of those kind of, you know, like, is it blue sound? No, not blue sound.
A white noise.
Yeah. I feel like it would really kind of like help concentration.
Yeah.
To some extent, like with a white noise kind of background, like the blue lighting.
Means that kind of everything else takes the focus and you've kind of got your brain taking over.
I can imagine if you're playing like an RPG, it would help with like, really bring your imagination to life and stuff.
Yeah,
kind of like almost kind of like one of those like sensory deprivation tanks.
Kind of lets you really visualize what's happening elsewhere.
Yeah, plus fish, they're cool.
Plus fish.
Right. So, what next? Where are we going next in your dream games night?
Okay. So the introductory game is going to be Coup. Expansion / variant on the Resistance. So I think that is always a really, really solid game to sort of start a games night with. I think pretty much any time I have a games night, I always crack out Coup, either at the start of the evening or at the end of the evening.
So why Coup instead of like Avalon or Resistance?
So I think the smaller player count is really, really handy. Because of my games nights, like we tend to only have about 4 or 5 people there, and the Resistance or Avalon, that really shines when you've got kind of 9 or 10 people, and by that point, there's not many other games that you can play with that kind of player count. So I think if you're playing Resistance, that's kind of your whole evening at that point. Whereas Coup, I feel like it's kind of a good lead into another game, where if you've got 4 people, 5 people, that's about perfect for Coup. and then you can then kick that off into playing something else.
Enough. That makes sense. So what's your let's play this pitch?
Okay.
To convince people to play it.
So I'm a bit weird, or maybe a bit weird, in that when I sell a game to people, I tend to start with a fiction and then go with the rules. So in Coup, you are playing as kind of a politically minded individual trying to claw your way up through the backstabbing politics of a dystopian future. And in order to do that, you're earning the alliance of different members of the kind of council of the world. So in terms of actual gameplay, what it is you have two cards in your hand that represent each of these two council members. So you've got the assassin, ambassador, contessa, captain, and duke. And the card in their hand represents the fact that you have their loyalty. And you can do different abilities on each of your turns, and you kind of go around like that. So the idea is you're trying to make enough money using the abilities on your cards to be able to backstab the other players, taking out their loyalty and leaving yourself as the only one with any loyalty left behind. Trick to the game, though, is that the cards you have in your hand are secret, so no one else can see them. And you can lie about what you have in your hand. So did you ever play the card game either Cheat or Bullshit, if I'm allowed to swear?
Yeah, fuck it, swear. I played Bullshit years ago.
Yeah, so we used to play that all the time in college, and it's basically a slightly more involved version of that. So you know when someone puts down four sixes and you've got two sixes in your hand and you think, I've got your number. And you call bullshit on that. It's like that, but with a little bit more of a kind of rule structure. But it still has that exact same vibe of like that kind of fast-paced lying and bluffing and things like that. So there's three of each card in the deck. So if you know that one's already come up, you've got one, and there's two other people saying they've got the Duke. Well, you know one of them's lying, but it's a case of, well, which one?
I like it. Can you remember the first time you played it?
Ooh, I think that was at one of our kind of games nights at my friend Luke's house. So he tends to be the one who kind of hosts all our games nights because he lives most central to all of us. He has a big living room with a big, big wooden table, which is always important.
Always helpful. And
so I used to play the Resistance a lot in university, to the point that actually my friends and I sort of hacked it so that it was just a reskin of it, but it was a bit more Harry Potter-esque. So it was Death Eaters versus the Order of the Phoenix, instead of the spies versus the Resistance. So I used to play that literally every Sunday for like 2 or 3 hours. There was about, like I say, 8, 9, 10 of us who would just play it all evening on a Sunday. So I have a great love for that game. And then when I was over at my friend's house for our games night, we were waiting for people to arrive, and it's just like, oh, should we have a game of Coup? So he just pulled that out, and I was like, this seems really familiar. Is this the Resistance? It's set in the same universe. But I just remember it immediately clicking for me and just being like, I see what this game is, what it does, and why it's just going to be great fun to actually get going and just like bluff, cheat, and lie your way to victory right into your friends' faces.
Yeah, that sounds awesome, man. Do you think do you think this game helps friendships? Or is it one of those that definitely causes arguments?
It depends what sort of friendship you have. You can definitely end up saying all sorts of insults to people during the course of playing the game. but as long as you can shake hands and laugh it off at the end, I think, it's definitely a good icebreaker game. I think it's definitely a good one to kind of get to know people because it's easy and simple and it's sort of very fast and snappy. But
I've always found that like social deduction kind of games make good icebreakers.
Yeah. No, definitely, definitely. I mean, like I say, I've got a huge love for the Resistance, but obviously Coup is just a little bit snappier, which is why I think it's a good intro game for a games night.
So, where are we going next? What do you want to talk about next in your dream games night?
So should we talk about who will be arriving to sit down with me as I'm dealing out the cards and getting ready to call everyone an asshole for lying about having a captain?
So who are you inviting to the fish room?
So I'll go through in no particular order. I think the first person whom I will invite is Brian David Gilbert, formerly of Polygon, now off on his own path, kind of general YouTube comedy video game sketch guy. Are you familiar with his stuff?
I'm not, no.
Yeah, he's absolutely fantastic. He has had a YouTube channel for a long time. And yeah, he's kind of done these weird, kind of slightly surreal, almost kind of vaguely Tim and Eric-esque kind of sketches and skits and things like that. But I and many other people first heard of him when he joined Polygon, the video games website, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he joined that maybe about 5 years ago or so, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. So he, yeah, he joined the Polygon kind of YouTube video team. And yeah, it was just absolutely hilarious and just an absolutely wonderful sense of humor.
Excellent. Cool. So what do you think they would bring to the game night experience?
Well, one is he is absolutely hilarious. He is genuinely very, very funny. But also, he is one of the driving people behind Polygon's Overboard board games series. So that's basically their kind of, they will play a board game and record themselves playing it. So I've heard of a bunch of great games from there, like Obscurio, I came across through there, and Wavelength. And yeah, some really, really nice games there. So he's clearly got a good head for board games and that sort of thing. So I think he'd be really a really solid person to play some games with and just kind of have a laugh.
Yeah, that sounds like a great guest.
So number two will be a slightly more famous person, is the actor and comedian Peter Serafinovich from Shaun of the Dead, John Wick, Guardians of the Galaxy, that sort of thing. Are you familiar with him?
I've got a feeling. Let me just Google his face.
Tall guy, dark hair, starry eyes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember now. He's funny.
The sommelier from John Wick, who only sells you a gun if you ask for it in terms of wine.
So do you think they'll get along with the other guests?
I would think so. He is a bit of a nerd himself. There's quite a fun little anecdote that I quite like about him. So I'm a big fan of the Dark Souls video game series. As is Peter Serafinovich. He is a big player of video games and particularly Dark Souls. So much so that when they were casting the voice cast for Dark Souls 2, he went out and basically begged to be a voice on Dark Souls 2 and actually got his voice in the game.
Awesome. I'd love to be like famous and just be like, please put my voice in it.
Just put me in this thing. I love it. Please.
It's like Alan Tudyk just keeps appearing in random Disney films. He's like a chicken.
It does. Yeah. It's exactly like that, yeah. So yeah, so he's definitely got a good kind of nerdy streak to him. But again, he's just a very, very funny man. He's just, if you've ever seen him on any panel shows or anything like that, he's just got a really quick wit. As an episode of 8 out of 10 Casters Countdown that he was on, he's just like stole the show on that. He's brilliant.
I'll have to have a look at that. Who's up next?
So I'll go for my third and final guest now. I think I'm going to keep to four people, just a little sort of smaller sort of engagement, but this is going to be a bit more off the wall. This is going to be the character of Naked Snake, aka Big Boss, from Metal Gear Solid 3.
Okay, so who's this? I've not played Metal Gear Solid.
Don't. As the biggest fan of Metal Gear Solid, it is too big a time and mental energy investment to try.
I've got plenty of time at the moment.
At your own peril, my friend.
So is he a good guy, bad guy, ice cream
so
man?
So he's the star of Metal Gear Solid 3. So the first two in the series, the earlier games in the series kind of set him up to be a villain, almost. He was kind of the leader of this kind of mercenary empire, but he's also kind of the most notorious sort of super soldier in the world. and he kind of has this huge myth about him. Like all of the previous games are kind of dealing with his legacy and this kind of world that he's created and set up and everything like that. So as you're playing through all these games, they're set in kind of the noughties, the near future of the 1990s when they were released. You kind of have this like big legend and myth about this guy. And then you play Metal Gear Solid 3, which is the prequel set in the 1960s. And suddenly he's just this slightly weird guy who is just like big nerd about guns and has nightmares about Dracula and is really awkward around an attractive woman. And all of these sorts of things that just completely upset everything you've heard about him so far. And you just play this game and you're just like, is this really the guy who he will later become? And obviously, as the games go on, they kind of explore his changing character. But I think that early person from that his kind of chronologically earliest incarnation, like I say, is just kind of a bit of a weird nerd. As are the rest of my guests. And yeah, he's just a kind of, seems like he just kind of gets stuck into something just because it's kind of caught his fancy. So hopefully, like I say, starting off with Coup, we'll kind of ease him into it and kind of get him stuck into it and break the ice a little bit.
So is that the game that you're most excited to play with him, Coup?
No, I think my second game is probably my centerpiece, pièce de résistance of the of the evening. But I think the first game is just a nice, like I say, icebreaker, kind of ease things into it.
All right, well, on that note then, do you want to talk about your second serving?
Yeah, so as I mentioned up at the top of the episode, I'm a big RPG enthusiast, so my second game, the main one, as I think a few of your previous guests have said, will be an RPG of some kind. Now I've had a big thing. I've kind of gone back and forth on this, but I think I'm probably going to go for, and this is going to make me sound like a huge hipster and weird nerd, but I'm going to go for Dungeons and Dragons.
You do? Oh yeah, D&D.
But Dungeons and Dragons from 1981 specifically.
when you said I want to play D&D, I was like, it's not going to be just fifth D&D.
No, I am too weird a nerd to go for that one.
So why this one? Was it 1991?
81. This is
1981.
Over a decade before I was born, James. I can't even claim.
So why? What edition was that? Was that
right? So this was almost pre first edition. Feel free to cut this if you need to. early on in Dungeons and Dragons, basically there was the original version of Dungeons and Dragons, OD&D, that was released in the 70s, and then they made the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which is first edition.
Oh, I've got that. I've got the starter set of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was my dad's. He gave it to me.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's really cool. Yeah, so at the same time, or kind of just before releasing AD&D, they also released what was essentially supposed to be an easy, simple, stripped-down version of the game that they called Dungeons & Dragons Basic.
Right.
And when people first started playing that basic version, that's also called the blue box or the blue set, basically when they released Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, people were like, no, stop. Take all these awful rules about skills and weapon styles and all of these different strange races and classes out. Bring me back the first one. So what the company did was basically expanded that basic Dungeons and Dragons, because that only allowed you to get a character up to level 3. Right. And they expanded that up to level 14 or 15, I think. And yeah, so they kept that really kind of simple, stripped down, almost introductory style version of the rules. And they just expanded that into its own full game. And that version of the game, it is basic/expert, is often called, or BX, you'll call it, just kind of has a really nice, simple, sort of clean play style to it that I really, really enjoy.
I thought I was a nerd.
This is the notorious version of the game where elf and dwarf are both classes, that you would play as opposed to choosing your race and class. Like I say, it just has a really nice, simple, core rule set. It does have a lot of free. Go on.
I did always wonder why that starter set that I've got is advanced D&D.
Yeah. So it does have a lot of weird rules because it was mainly focused on dungeon crawling at the time.
Yeah.
It was the era of the
10-foot pole.
Exactly, yeah. So it has a lot of rules about like searching for hidden doors and how far you can move in a turn and opening stuck doors and things like that. And I tried playing with those rules and I just found it slowed things down a lot. But if you kind of strip all that back and just take the core rules of like the classes and the rules for like interacting with NPCs and interacting with the world, I just find it just gives you like a really punchy, really nice game that benefits a lot from role-playing.
Yeah.
In the sense that some of the more mechanically complex games I find sort of take away from that, you know. So is this
what has led to like the OSR stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So OSR, old school Renaissance, is the main way, but it's also old school revival, old school rules, old school role playing, old school whatever. Yeah, that basically came from the idea of as the newer and newer editions of D&D included all these different rules about like different skills and different races and mechanical interactions and things like that. You then have this group of people who are like, well, hang on, I don't want these complex rules and things like that. And just kind of have either revived these old games and kind of basically taken the rules and presented them in a way that's a bit more modern, or they've taken inspiration from those old rules and kind of drawn those forward into some completely new modern games.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like I say, the main philosophy of those sorts of games is the phrase, the answer is not on your character sheet. And I think that's something that I really try and push for when I'm running a role-playing game, when I'm GMing, is I'll kind of describe a situation, describe a scenario, describe a puzzle or a combat encounter or a role-play encounter or something, and try and encourage the players to kind of, rather than looking on their character sheet to think like, oh, okay, I've got high persuasion, so I'm going to try and persuade him, or, ooh, my athletics is pretty good, maybe I can try and break something. Instead, it's like, think about the situation around you and think about how you would interact with the world.
Yeah, I get that.
It's not for everyone, obviously, and it is a particular style of play, but, I've been playing role-playing games for like half my life at this point, on and off. And yeah, I just think as I've kind of gone forward, I've almost gone back, as it were.
And at the end of the day, it's your last games night on Earth, so what you say goes.
Indeed.
So, have you got any funny anecdotes?
So I was running a game of BX D&D a little while ago. I was running a module called The Knight at the Golden Duck by Patrick Stewart. Not that Patrick Stewart, another Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewarts?
Many, many Patrick Stewarts. So it's basically like a pseudo murder mystery kind of thing set in an inn called the Inn of the Golden Duck. And there's this kind of mystical treasure that's hidden somewhere in the inn. The characters are all kind of stuck there overnight. And obviously, as the night progresses, murders happen, intrigue happens, all that sort of thing. And the characters had been antagonizing, the player characters had been antagonizing this character named Dr. Rourke, who is a crow and doctor and therapist. And they were just kind of bullying and antagonizing him. And basically, he was a spy. And he was trying to incriminate them, or particularly incriminate one of them, basically in his own murder. So mm-hmm. He kind of staged his own murder in his room up to and including the point of actually dying in the course of staging his own murder, and tried to set up Wilbur, the magic user, as his murderer. And there was just this wonderful scene where two of the characters were kind of investigating the room. And like I say, I wasn't asking for skill checks or things like that. I was just describing the room to them. And they were saying, okay, I want to check the bed. I want to check the window frame. I want to check out the window. And yeah, it just kind of had this investigation where they were putting the clues together. And then they go downstairs for this kind of pseudo courtroom scene. And everyone's having this big argument, except for Wilbur, the character who's been accused, because at this point, he has no idea that he's actually been set up or framed for murder. So he's kind of still trying to antagonize people. Of course, out of character, he does know, the player does know that he's been accused of murder, but he's just kind of digging himself a bigger and bigger hole by incriminating himself more and more, I think probably intentionally at this point, whilst all of his friends are actually trying to defend him, and he's just making it worse and worse.
Yeah, it sounds really cool, this like the stripped back yeah, role playing.
Like I say, it just means that people are kind of really dialed in and engaged to what's actually happening in the world, and it's just really, really, it's just nice, quite punchy.
Is it quite easy to teach?
I find it is, yeah. So again, as part of my job as a teacher, I have run a D&D club in the college before, and I've introduced a lot of people to RPGs outside of that as well. And yeah, I think for people who've never role played before, I think a game with fewer rules and fewer mechanical restrictions on your interactions with the world does allow for a much easier kind of pathway into role playing, because you just kind of say, like, look, you are playing as Wilbur the magic user. What do you do here? You know, and there's not really any consideration of, like, I sound like I'm just dunking on 5e. But just like, there's no consideration of, like, ah, well, you've already used your bonus action for this thing, but if you still have your interact action, then you could do this. And then you've got your main action that you can then turn into a move action and move, you know, it just kind of, there's a bit less of that and a bit more like, right, what do? You right now here in the moment. And it just kind of, it's quite grounded, I think, in quite a nice kind of punchy way.
That I can see why, yeah, you'd prefer that. So where are we going next with the games night?
So I think I'll briefly mention the music. I'm not going to kind of go too far into it, but obviously that is always a terribly important part of a games night is the music.
I think so.
So in keeping with the very relaxing theme, and I think this might be the thing that puts people to sleep, even if the aquarium isn't, but my absolute favourite thing to have on when gaming is a good bit of lo-fi.
All right, okay.
Are you familiar with this relatively recent explosion in the kind of lo-fi hip-hop genre, as it's called?
I've heard it. I wouldn't exactly call myself a fan.
that is entirely fair.
I've put it on. I clicked a Spotify playlist once, and you are correct. I'm pretty sure I fell asleep.
Yes. I think it's like you said before, though. I think it's almost like white noise, but music instead of white noise. But yeah, whenever
I don't think people would stay playing games for too long if you were just pumping in white noise. This is starting to feel a little bit like an experiment.
Steadily increasing the volume of the white noise, just louder and louder until you're trying to shout over it about hitting something with your axe. So yeah, so I think I just kind of keep it that nice, chill, lo-fi music. That's what I tend to play when I'm doing my board
games.
Do you
want, like, a live DJ?
Ooh, now that's a good point, actually. Yeah, if this is my last perfect games night, then yeah, I think I would have.
I mean, you're not footing the bill, so.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, I'd hire a DJ to kind of put together a perfect playlist of kind of escalating action and as much escalating action as you can get with lo-fi, but just kind of that following the ebb and flow of the evening and kind of, yeah, giving you something a bit jazzier in your dialogue scenes, a little bit snappier in your combat scenes and that sort of thing. And that'd be really nice.
No, I get it. Third game. Possibly the most important game of the night. The one that people will remember you for.
Yeah. So, as I said, similar to coup. I think I want something that's nice and simple and a good kind of wind down.
Yeah, send people off in a good mood.
Exactly, yeah. So we've had our old school D&D. We've kind of had a bit of a laugh, a bit of excitement, maybe a bit of combat or dialogue or whatever, something a bit more cerebral. So my last game is going to be Azul, as I mentioned before.
Very pretty game.
Yeah. So I think that's a nice important thing is when you're finishing, even if you don't necessarily do terribly well at Azul, you still have a lot of nice things to look at and nice pretty patterns to make on the board and things like that. Always appeals to me.
I love like tile placement games where at the end, like you get to look at what you've created. So like, you know, like patchwork and stuff, I always find it quite satisfying looking at like the blanket that you've made.
Yeah, it definitely has that same kind of vibe of yeah, you've kind of got this perfect thing. And especially when you've kind of made loads of columns or you've got all your colours out or things like that.
Do you want to give us a quick sales pitch of Azul?
Yeah. So again, starting with a fiction, you are a tile mason in Portugal, and you are tiling the prince's palace or something along those lines. And so you have to assemble the tiles along the wall in a particular order. So the way that you do that is you have a bunch of kind of piles of tiles in the center of the table. And you can, with four people, I think there's nine of them, and you have to pick all of the ones of a certain color off one of the piles and then put all the rest in the middle. And you do that to basically fill up some rows of 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 tiles. And then once you've done that, you can actually cement them into the wall. It's a lot easier when you're actually looking at the board. I've just realized how hard it is to describe it verbally. You're making pretty patterns with tiles.
You do a pretty pattern. Sounds cool. Very visually pleasing and a complex puzzle to solve.
Yeah. One of the things I appreciate the most about Azul, and it actually took me a little while before I fully kind of clicked in my head, but all of the information in Azul is completely open to the table. And I think that really benefits, particularly if you're trying to teach someone new. You know, if you're trying to teach someone if you're trying to teach someone coup or resistance or something like that, you almost have to do a dummy round where you're like, okay, so I'm going to open my card up to show you that I'm a spy, but you have to pretend that you don't know I'm a spy and that sort of thing. Whereas with Azul, because all of the tiles are out on the table, all of your tiles are open on your board, you can just talk people through what they might want to do there. So it's got a lot of strategy to it, but I also find it really sort of, I guess, inclusive, accessible, that's the word.
Yeah.
I just find it very accessible as a game. I actually got a copy of Azul for my dad and my stepmom for Christmas just gone. And the three of us just played a game together on Christmas Day evening. And it was just really, really nice. Like, they aren't board gamers at all. I think, you know, Monopoly and Trivial Pursuit are the ones that they would tend to play. But I just kind of went out on a limb. I was just like, yeah, they'd probably quite like Azul. So I just picked them up a copy. And my stepmom was about to win until my dad intentionally sort of cut her off and shunted a bunch of excess tiles she didn't need on her and lost her a bunch of points, which meant that I ended up winning. But yeah, like I say, she's not a board gamer, but it's just a nice, accessible game. But like you say, it does have a good bit of strategy as well. So you've got to kind of, you do have to be switched on if you want to kind of do well at it. But at the same time, you don't need to kind of read a 70-page rule book to understand it. You know, you can look at the board, have someone explain it to you and be playing and doing well in like 5 minutes.
Games that are really inclusive like that are great for... you know, you can take it to, like you say, family Christmases and stuff and convince people to play. They're always going to have a place in people's hearts.
Yeah.
But what do you think makes Azul particularly unique?
Like I say, I think on top of the fact that the information is open, so everyone's kind of strategizing about the same thing, I think it's just the fact that like we said, it's just got a wonderful kind of aesthetic to it. You're kind of assembling this wonderful wall and you kind of have this strategy in mind, but the payoff for the strategy as well as the thrill of victory is that you can look back and you kind of are looking at this thing that you've actually created and put together. You know, our friend Dave, Dungeons and Flagons frequent guest, I introduced it to him over Tabletop Simulator quite recently, and I cannot beat him at it. I have never, ever beaten him at Azul. he had never played it before, but he's just very good at patterns and pattern recognition and things like that. And so...
Some people, if a game's got like a pattern to see, they just get it and you just cannot beat them.
She's got a good hook to it where you really have something that you are putting together over the course of the game and you can see what you're working towards as opposed to kind of just accumulate 14 victory points or whatever.
Is there anything else you'd like to add for your perfect games night?
Obviously, what would a games night be without a bit of food and drink?
Mm-hmm. I'll go on.
So I think food, a slightly boring choice.
I don't think there is any boring food.
It's got to be pizza. Has to be.
Fair enough. How's the game served, though?
I think you've got to have a side table for the pizza. I think if it's my last games night on Earth, I'm going to go for the good old guilty pleasure of that slightly greasy takeaway pizza. Just that one that kind
dirty
of...
Dirty pizza.
The dirty pizza, yeah. The one that kind of really hits the spot that you wish you didn't have the spot for it to hit. But my God, does it satisfy that very particular need? So yeah, you've got to have a separate table. You don't want anything kind of getting onto the board games or anything like that. So I think just kind of have a handful of boxes there and then just let people kind of go at it throughout the evening. I think just keep it nice and simple comfort food there.
Would you allow pizza in your in real life game sessions?
I tend to, yeah. Well, at least when we can. Obviously, Dungeons and Flagons can't exactly run across to the Domino's and bring a pizza back, but...
yeah, I think the landlord would have something to say about that.
Perhaps. But when I'm playing in a home game, I think pizza is quite often a good choice because it's one of those ones where, you know, you can kind of pick at it throughout the evening. You know, you can kind of eat it while you're standing up and... you know, you can just grab a slice, get that down in a couple of minutes, and then, you know, leave it 10 minutes until the next one kind of thing. So I think it's a good games night pizza, you know.
I do know some people who outright ban pizza from games nights. And personally, I think it's a great game nights food. But what's your favourite topping?
Oh, I think I'm a pepperoni man.
We asked the hard questions here at last games night on Earth.
Yeah. I think I would like a good variety in my last games night, my perfect games night. I think I'd want, you know, one pepperoni one just cheese and tomato one.
Mm, I get that.
Like meat feasty one. But I think if I had to cut it down to just one, I think it would just be your good old double pepperoni, double cheese, just that really decadent, meaty, greasy, cheesy one.
Two of the good
sounding
stuff,
like
please.
An absolute rat right now.
I know what you mean though. I love it. I love it when you go places and they're doing like pizza by the slice, and I'm like, I can have a whole pizza, because like half and half is good, but like a whole pizza made of different slices,
yeah,
sign me up.
Yeah, definitely.
Go on.
So
then.
Yeah,
that'd
be my food. I think drinks wise, I'm not a huge alcohol drinker, but I do love a good light ale, like an IPA or a pale ale or something along those lines.
Hipster.
You know it. I think I'd have a tap with a couple of different ales on.
You want one tap with different ales coming through?
A miscellaneous. I shouldn't have said that to a barman. I shouldn't have said that. I want X taps, where X is the number of beers available. There we go.
No. No, he's talking maths.
So I'd have a handful of beers on tap that we can just kind of go to the bar person and pull the perfect pint.
Have you got a go-to ale?
I quite like, what's the brewery that does the like Golden Champion, Thirsty Ferret, that sort of thing?
Oh, Badger Beers, that is. Yeah. I'm going to edit the shit out of that and make it look like I knew it.
Oh, so I can't know it. You ask me and then, oh, no, you know it. Okay. What's the brewery that does that, like, Thirsty Ferret and, like, Golden Champion and those sorts of ones?
Not a clue, mate.
Come on. yeah, with the big, like, black banner with Badger on it. Yeah, so I like all of those ones. They've just got a nice kind of sweet, fruity flavor to them, but still got that kind of hoppiness to them as well that I really like in a good pale ale.
Excellent. That sounds nice. All right. So anything else?
I think that's about it, to be honest. I know that you've had a few people who've said things like they'd want a Nintendo Wii or things like that there. But no, I think I just want to keep focused on the games, just have a good few drinks, good pizza, and just kind of hang out and play some games.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Excellent. Right. So that brings us to the roundup. Do you want to round up your Dream Games Night for us?
So it is in the Blue Planet Aquarium in front of the big floor-to-ceiling tank.
Big old fish room.
Big old fish room. We have Brian David Gilbert, Peter Serafinovich, and Naked Snake, a.k.a. Big Boss, as the guests. We have a side table with pizza and a mini bar with a few Badger Brewery ales on tap.
Pizza.
And indeed, pizza.
I could go for a pizza right about now.
I would kill a pizza.
I've got leftovers. And,
we have, to start with, Koo, as people are kind of settling in and getting to know each other. We have old school Dungeons & Dragons for a good bit of chatting and role play. And then we have Azul to kind of wind down and finish off any leftover pizza.
Brilliant, mate. So you have the choice now between a joke from my super awesome joke book that you know well, or a tabletop question. Which would you like?
You know me, James. You know I like to show off a little bit. So go on, give me the question.
Right. Tabletop question is, name this game from the first line of its Board Game Geek. Description from publisher. 1-6 player cooperative game of terrifying cave escape.
That would be Subterra, I think.
Yes, congratulations. You are smart.
Oh, you know just how to get to me, James.
Yeah. Let us know at LGNOE podcast on Twitter if you got that right, listeners. All right. Anything to plug?
Yeah. So I will first of all plug my Twitter. So I am at JR Sison. So that's the letter J, the letter R, and then Sison. So I don't tweet that much, but I tend to retweet a lot of cool RPG things that I find. So if you want that kind of feed cultivation, follow me for that. I'm also going to plug my newly started itch.io storefront. I only have two things up there at the moment, a weird lightweight Blades in the Dark hack that I wrote, and a little item profile for old school D&D. But I intend to put a few things up there. So if you have an itch account, you can follow that at jsice, so there's jaysys.itch.io. So jaysys.itch.io.
Excellent, cool. So last question of the night, Jonathan. What does tabletop mean to you?
I have been having to think about this, and I think for me, it is companionship. I think yeah, both as a thing itself. I think tabletop gaming has been a pretty steadfast companion to me over the years. I think I've always been a board gamer. I've always liked my RPGs and all that sort of thing. And I think companionship in the sense of friends as well. pretty much all of my best friends I have met through role-playing games or board games, and yeah, I wouldn't have it any other way. I think that it's just such a fantastic way to just create those kind of long-lasting bonds that are really, really important.
Brilliant. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jonathan. I hope you enjoyed it.
I certainly did, James. Yeah, thank you very much for having me. We're very excited. No worries.
Well, outro, please.
Thanks again to our guest this week, and thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to people, give us a follow on social media, and follow the podcast wherever you're listening. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on social media at LGNOE Podcast. You can email us at lastgamesnightonearth@dungeonsandflagons.co.uk, and check out dungeonsandflagons.co.uk for more information about all of our events. See you soon. Once again, I've been James, and this has been Last Games Night on Earth.